Hello and welcome to Lennox Crazy Podcast. By popular demand, I have a special interview today, Daniel Robbins, the guy who created Gen2 Linux and wrote lots of IBM Developer Works articles. And it doesn't stop there. His current project is fun too. Hi, Daniel, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Who is Daniel Robbins?
I ask myself that many times. I'm just a guy who I like, working on code, hacking on projects, and some stuff I worked on became pretty popular. I think that's about it. But other than that, I like just messing with things and getting things working and learning things. I guess that's probably a summary of who I am.
What has your journey been with Linux, and how did it start?
Well, let's see. At the beginning, I was working at the University of New Mexico as a system administrator, and it was actually for a Windows NT4 network. And what happened is that I got everything running pretty smoothly, and I installed Debian Linux on a server. I believe it was 1.3. And I started using Debian, and I thought it was interesting. I didn't really like their package manager, though. It was dpackage at the time. So I started looking at other Linux distributions. I got involved with Stampede Linux as a user and then as a developer. And again, I sort of looked at their package manager and didn't quite like what I saw. So I started to look at how I could improve it. It was a binary package manager, actually, that I was looking at, and I made some improvements to it. I designed a new system that made it more modern, more flexible, but they weren't really receptive to the changes. Or many of the developer, I wouldn't say many, but there were probably, I would say, there was at least one outspoken developer who was just sort of nitpicking every little thing I did, and I just thought, instead of sort of putting up with this kind of unpleasantness, I could just go and create something myself. And then I could do whatever I wanted, and I wouldn't have to, it wouldn't be political. I wouldn't have to try to convince this person who seems very unwilling to accept any of my ideas to consider my ideas. I could just do them. So that's what I decided to do. I left Stampede, and I started my own distribution. It was called Enoch, and I thought, since I'm doing everything by myself, I'm going to need to automate this system really well. So the first thing I focused on was basically recording everything, all the steps that I had to do to build it into recipes, into build scripts, so that I could automate it. And so I wouldn't have to, I could reduce any manual labor required to a bare minimum. So that's what I did, and I worked on Enoch for a while. Then at a certain point, I got a little frustrated with Linux, and to be honest, I can't remember exactly why. I think it was stability issues, because I actually had a flaky motherboard, but I thought it was Linux's fault.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I tried FreeBSD, and it didn't trigger the bug that was on the hardware. I used FreeBSD for about 6 months, got familiar with ports on FreeBSD, and then sort of missed Linux. So I got some new hardware, went back to Linux, and then took some of the ideas I learned from FreeBSD and incorporated them into Enoch, and that grew to become Gen2.
Would you briefly detail the process and reasons for leaving Gen2 originally?
Originally was back in, 2004. So Gen2 had grown to be a very large project, and it basically was very demanding of my time. And I was focusing more on how to grow the organization of Gen2 and on running the Gen2 store. to provide us with the revenue stream. And I think I just was doing too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got burnt out, and I was also under a lot of financial pressure, so where I needed regular income. So it just became difficult to sort of manage everything. And I think I also got a little depressed just about the state of our development tools and our development model. That was before Git was around, really. So I was sort of thinking there's got to be a better way to do this, but I don't see it right now. I don't see how this can really scale very well.
How do you plan to avoid these kinds of constraints with the new project, with the new project Fund 2?
Well, I think the key thing with Fund 2 is sort of like my re-entry into the world of Gentoo. And what I'm trying to do is do some innovative things that support the Gentoo project. I'm not trying to compete with Gentoo as much as I'm trying to really harness the energy and the innovation that's in sort of the greater Gentoo community that doesn't always reside with the official developers and the official project. And find ways to really harness that through distributed tools like Git. And I think another key thing for me is just, you know, I think I've learned a lot from the experience that I don't want to bite off more than I can chew. I think this time around, I actually have a really good team of people sort of looking out for me and giving me critical feedback. That's something that was missing in the Gentoo days. I think many of the developers were glad to be there, but I didn't get critical feedback early when I could really act on it. So I think that's a key thing. I'm also really focusing more on communication, direct communication with users. I have a blog, I have a website, fun2.org, that I'm trying to design to be more of a portal to inform people and to get people the latest stuff. So those are some of the ways.
And also the IRC on Freenode is a great place to come visit the people of Fun2.
Right, yeah. We have a Fun2 channel there that has about 20 to 25 people in it, typically, which I'm really impressed with, just because Fun2 hasn't really been around that long. So the IRC channel is great as well.
What aspects of Gentoo do you feel the developers and maintainers have got right?
I think Gentoo has done a good job with preserving this idea of choice. So Gentoo shouldn't tell you, is basically giving the user the ability to decide what they're doing with their system. So I think that's been preserved really well. And I think that there's been a lot of work on the portage tree, on the packages in the portage tree.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's grown to be quite huge. So it's, you know, there's been a lot of packages added. I think that's been done well. I think the thing I'm impressed with most with Gentoo is the user community around it. I just think the users are really, really amazing, and they do a lot of cool stuff with it, and that is a good sign, I think.
What is it about Gentoo you would like to see improved?
There's a lot of things. The main thing, though, is right now, Gentoo, they are trying to improve it. They are trying to work on its weaknesses, and no project is perfect. But I do think Gentoo tends to sort of have a cloistered set of developers. As a generalization, they're not always open to input or collaboration with the larger Gentoo community. And just due to the nature of the portage tree, So Gentoo has one portage tree, and basically all developers work on that tree. Or there's one sort of blessed tree, even though some people are working in overlays and other things. But because of that, and you have all of these people who historically have been committing to this one tree, there's had to be a lot of policy and procedure on how to do things the right way so that somebody doesn't mess up somebody else. So there's a lot of sort of stepping on each other's toes and rules that tends to slow development down. Sometimes if you're adding a new feature to Gen 2, you might have to touch a lot of different e-builds that are not maintained by the same people. So if you need to put that into a central tree, then all of a sudden what ends up happening is you need to coordinate with those people. You need to have discussions. Well, they may not agree with how you're doing things, so then you need to either convince them or incorporate their ideas into your plan, and it just becomes a very complicated process. I just think that today, with the development tools we have with Git, that model isn't necessary anymore. And I think that with a distributed development model, you can have small teams that are relatively autonomous, working on specific areas that they're interested in. And that tends to be a much more efficient model. It's also more pleasant for developers. And you don't have to have as much red tape, as much bureaucracy. People generally just want to code. They want to improve their distribution. They don't want to police people or write rules. But with the sort of a centralized model, that does become necessary. And it sort of becomes a catch-22 where, you want to get things done, but then you don't want to have people mess each other up. You add rules and it's not necessarily a pleasant environment. So I think that's the main area where Gentoo needs improvement. I do think that you can point out a lot of problems with the Gentoo project, but I think at a fundamental level, they all sort of stem from that one core problem.
As the founder, you have seen all aspects of Gentoo. How would you bring the Gentoo community closer together?
I think the key thing is to move to a distributed model of development where people can organize and work on stuff that they like to work on. To make that happen, basically any person who is sort of getting involved with Gen 2 needs to be able to build the entire OS, to run the whole OS, and to test it. That's something that my boss at work talks a lot about, but basically I don't think it's good enough to just have somebody out there who can build a release of Gentoo. Anybody needs to know how that works. And then with a distributed tool like Git, they can easily fork Gentoo or fork Funtoo and do their own cool thing with it. And I think that's really the key to improving things. If you can get smaller groups working relatively autonomously with the tools and understanding they need to really get involved in whatever area of Gentoo they want without stepping on somebody else's toes, I think that's the key to improving Gentoo.
What open source software can you not live without on your network at home and at work?
The key stuff is SSH, Screen, and Vim. And Python.
Which open source programs would you like to see developed?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not an expert on what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm focusing more on the core tools of Gentoo and Funtoo, so I don't always know all the cool stuff that's out there. So if I tell you something that I'd like to see developed, it's very possible that it's already being developed.
Gotcha. Tell me about your latest project.
Well, my latest project is Metro, which is it's something that I did basically to help me build up new releases of Gentoo and of Funtoo. I started using Gentoo's Catalyst tool, and I was actually using that for quite a while to build up current releases of Gentoo, like daily builds that I was featuring on my website at fun2.org. But as I wanted to add more stuff, it just was very difficult to do that. And it was, the code was also kind of complicated for me to follow, and I just, at a certain point, it became more practical for me to rewrite it from scratch. So that's what I did. And I tried to design a really elegant tool to build up entire releases of Gentoo. So that's what Metro is. And it has a very different design than the old Catalyst tool does. I think a lot better design. And I have documentation online that you can get to from my site if people want to try it out. What it lets you do is you can build up, you can literally do everything that I am doing on my website. Like, I'm building up daily customized versions of Gentoo as well as daily stable versions of Gentoo for all these different sub-architectures. And you can literally use the same script that I do to build up those releases, as well as do your own custom variations of Gentoo with your own packages and use variables and all that stuff.
What programming language is Metro written in?
It's written in Python.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I just did a, I just used your guide to do my first stage build with Metro, and it went real smooth. It was pretty neat, really. I didn't have any idea it was going to be that easy.
Cool. Well, I use it every day. I run it 3 times for my cron job, so it gets a good amount of testing, and that's how I wanted the tool to be. I wanted it to be something that people can rely on for a reliable build so that they can go into it and it just works. And they don't go into it and, oh, something broke because somebody hasn't built up a release for 2 months and something changed. I want it to just work every time. So I'm glad to hear that.
What resources have you found most helpful when troubleshooting your latest project?
What resources when troubleshooting it? Well, you know, I had to look at the current Catalyst and try to understand how it was doing things, but at a certain point it sort of became complicated to figure out what it was actually doing, and I had to sort of go through the fundamental steps of how to build up Gentoo, build up a stage 1 tarball, stage 2 tarball, stage 3 tarball. So, you know, I looked at the Catalyst code. And then, of course, I always look at the Python documentation when I'm trying to do new stuff,
mm-hmm.
or I forget how to do old stuff. So the Python documentation at python.org is good, or I just Google for information.
As the open source community interface at Microsoft, what did you learn that you are now using to make Fun2 a better project?
Good question. I had some insight into the Vista development process and how it differed from Linux, and that there are certain benefits to it, and obviously there were a lot of problems to it. I think that it helped me formulate my ideas about having small autonomous teams be able to sort of direct their own path more, rather than having a very large structure that's managed from the top, because that didn't seem to work very well for Microsoft. They actually had to do a reset on the development of Vista. It was originally a large portion of it was written in .NET, and they had to basically do a reset and base it off of Windows Server 2003. And then even then, you know, they really struggled with the release, and it was delayed, and I think a lot of that stemmed from basically that the teams weren't able to organically define their relationships with other teams. They were stuck in this structure that was defined by managers. So for Fun2, what I'm trying to do is basically help support Gentoo by promoting Git, looking for ways to use it for the portage tree, for example, provide tools for building the entire OS so anybody, you can have a group of three people work on your own little Gentoo-based distro. And then those little groups can chart their own course, and they can decide how they want to work with other groups who may be doing a similar thing. I think that's really key, to have that sort of organic, self-organizing structure where, you know, each group gets to figure out, you know, how they want to work with everybody else. I think that's key.
Were there a lot of Linux users at Microsoft?
There weren't like a ton.
Right.
Like, people weren't coming to me from all over the place saying, yeah, I use Linux, it really rocks. But, you know, every now and then you'd run into somebody who really liked Linux who worked there. And they were all, people who used Linux were, you know, always pretty excited about open source. And, you know, there's definitely people at Microsoft who really like open source software, who like Linux, who like GNU stuff. They're there.
Would you compare the Gentoo stage release process and the Metro and elaborate on some of the difficulties that the original Catalyst code base has caused?
Well, Catalyst originally was created by a developer. The concept was created by a developer, the initial prototype was. And then I really took over development and pushed it towards, with the help of some other developers. Basically, it was a tool to build up any version of any release of Gentoo, because before that we had, like, the PowerPC guys were using their own scripts. The Spark guys might be using their own scripts too, so we'd get slightly different results. So it was a way to standardize. And it did that job really well. So we had one tool that we were using to build. It got things consistent. We used the same process. That was good. The way I left Catalyst, though, it was kind of limited. It was basically this big black box, and you fed it like six parameters. And from that, it would build the Gentoo release. And that big black box was a lot of complicated Python code. And over time, as more and more features were added to Catalyst, it just became very, very complicated. So if you went and looked at that code, it would be very difficult to sort of figure out sort of the linear steps that it would go through to actually do everything. Mm-hmm. So what I did with Metro is I basically said, okay, we can't have all this complex logic wrapped up in all these Python classes that are interacting with each other. And what we need to do is have the complex logic in recipes, and have these recipes written in Bash, and have them resemble the actual commands that are used if you were to do this from Bash, sort of like how an e-build is supposed to be similar to the actual steps that you'd use to build up a package, although that isn't always true anymore because of a lot of e-class use and stuff like that. But so basically I broke out, I took that complex logic that was in Catalyst, analyzed it, broke it into a recipe, wrote it in Bash, and I made the core of Catalyst basically just execute that recipe. So that way, if you want to modify what Catalyst does, you don't have to modify the Catalyst source code. You can just modify the recipes that it's running. So that's a really key difference. The other thing is that I just made it a lot more flexible. Like the original Catalyst for my build script, I had a really complicated build script to work with Catalyst, and I basically looked at that script and I said, let's look at all these weird steps that I'm doing to make it work with Catalyst, and then let me look for ways that I can eliminate the need for those steps. like one of the things that I had to do with Catalyst is I had to move stuff from the Catalyst temporary directory to my mirror layout. I just lay out how I wanted my mirror to look on disk. So my script would have to basically copy from the Catalyst structure that it used in VarTemp Catalyst, and it would have to basically translate between that and my mirror layout and make sure everything was up to date. And I thought, well, why can't I just have Catalyst write into my mirror layout directly? And I'll set up a way so that people can define their own mirror layouts and they don't have to change the Catalyst source code or write a complicated script to ferry stuff back and forth. They can just say, okay, Catalyst, or okay, Metro, here's where everything is, here's its layout, here's where you should look for stuff, and here's where you should put stuff. And so that really simplified things. And then the other thing is just there's a lot of data involved in building up a release, and I really tried to provide some organization to that data, so it's not just sort of a flat dump of information like use variables and C flags and all that, but it's more organized and structured and extensible. So I have a parser. I have basically a data model for the recipes and sort of like a template engine in there as well. So there's a lot more on that front in Metro than Catalyst.
Yeah, I'm new to Python, so I'll get a kick out of looking at the code of Metro.
Everything is good in Metro's code, except I was writing the parser. That's the thing that parses the recipes. And I tried out new ideas, and some of them stuck and some of them didn't. And the parser, my data model basically went in directions that I wasn't intending from the beginning as I found new concepts that worked. And I kept messing with the code. So my parser code in Python is not something I'm proud of at all. I'm basically treating it like disposable code. And within the next few months, I'm just going to completely rewrite it and get it looking nice. But the rest of the Metro code in Python is actually pretty good. It's very clean.
How did you come up with the name Metro?
I don't know. I was kind of thinking of a name, and I was in Montreal, and they have a nice subway system, and that's what I chose to go with, just because it gets you around quickly.
Yep. Your can-do attitude is very refreshing. How was it developed?
Well, I think really one of the keys to the fact that I've been pretty successful with technology is that I try not to get intimidated by something when it seems complex. You know, when you're dealing with computers and technology, you always run into issues where something's very complex. And then there's the potential you could get afraid to ask questions. Maybe I'm just dumb and I should be able to figure this out, you know. Well, I always start from the standpoint that technology should be easy to use and intuitive. So if something's complicated, I'm not afraid to ask a question because I figure if it were better designed, it wouldn't be complicated. So that tends to give me the confidence to just sort of plow through things, figure out how things work. And then when it's possible, rewrite that code to make it simpler, make it more intuitive, more maintainable, more pleasant to use. Because I think really the key that a lot of people forget when they sort of get involved in code is that we get to decide how the technology works. You know, we get to define the conventions that are used, the command line interface, the user interface, and there's a lot of creative ways that we can make technology better. So you don't have to sort of accept the status quo. You can change it.
What are some of the interesting uses for OpenVZ?
Well, one of the things that Metro does is it builds up OpenVZ templates. And OpenVZ is, for people who don't know, it's a lightweight virtualization technology. It's actually often referred to as like a containers type technology. And the way it works is that basically, even though you're doing what looks like virtualization, you only have one Linux running on your machine. It's you have one kernel on there, but you can run many basically virtual Linux machines on the same box, and it's very efficient because it has only one kernel. So the uses, I think it's used a lot in ISPs where you have a lot of similar nodes on a box, so you can use it for hosting. It's really good. It's also just really good for, I find, for an individual developer workstation. Like if you need to fire up a new virtual box, a new instance to mess around, you can fire it up, mess around with stuff, and then blow it away when you're done. So it's really useful for that. And then also, I mean, it can be really handy if you, let's say you have some existing systems you need to keep running. You don't really want to redeploy them. They're working fine, but you want to use a newer version of Linux. You can just put OpenVZ on the box, and you can sort of migrate existing Linux systems into virtual containers, virtual environments, as they're called in OpenVZ. So one of the things that I really like OpenVZ a lot, so one of the things that I do is I build up daily, in addition to my sort of daily updated Gen 2 and Fun 2 releases, I build up daily OpenVZ templates, which are just tarballs that can be used to create new OpenVZ virtual environments. So I have those on my site as well.
What are some of the advantages of using the Fun2.org portage tree?
I think the key thing, what we're doing with the Fun2.org portage tree is I basically took the Gen 2 tree and I put it in Git. So we're using Git as the way to store it rather than CVS. So that's a big, huge improvement right there for development. But you can also use Git to actually distribute it. So instead of doing an emerge sync, you can actually do a Git pull, and it's very efficient. It seems to be just as efficient or even more efficient than an rsync. I think the key thing, though, for Fun2, for the whole point of the Fun2 tree is you can fork it. Because it's in Git, you can create your own copy of the whole repository and start tweaking it. And I think that's really a key thing. The other thing is we are putting some improvements in as we find ways to improve things. Like I have a new version of the init scripts in there, the OpenRC init scripts by Roy Marples.
Mm-hmm.
And I also I rewrote the UDEV e-build because I thought it could be improved. Well, actually needed some improvement to work with OpenRC better, so I did that. So we have a new UDEV in there. So I'm focusing on core packages to improve them, looking at ways to improve them to make sure things build well and work reliably. But then, you know, if you use the Fun2 portage tree, another cool thing is you can collaborate with us too, because if you have packages you want to add, we're trying to set up a network of trusted people where you can basically send change sets that eventually end up in a change set that I add to my tree. So I think that's a real key thing, because I think all of us know that the Gen 2 developers, they can get behind on bugs and Bugzilla. It's very easy to do. But it's nice to know that there's other options to address those bugs or to add new e-builds. So we want to be open to that and look at ways to, you know, get some new e-builds in the tree, get some bugs fixed, where you don't need to become a Gen 2 developer necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming a Gen 2 developer is kind of tricky these days. You have to learn a lot of policies and rules. Those policies and rules are important if you're committing to a centralized tree, a blessed tree. But if you're using a distributed model, a lot of them aren't so important. I'm mainly interested in, does the e-build work for you? Have you tested it for you? If so, then I can worry about if you generated a proper manifest when I add it to my tree. I don't need you to worry about that too much on the finesse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the key thing, the collaboration. I mean, you can send me change sets and I can add them.
When you left Gen 2, you set up the Gen 2 Foundation Incorporated. What sort of corporate structure did you intend?
That's a good question. Now, before the Gen 2 Foundation came about, I did look into a lot of different ways to structure Gen 2. One of the things I looked at was actually making little video games on live CDs and using that to generate revenue that would fund the project. Because I thought that actually bringing in revenue was important to help move the project to the next level. And I knew I needed to get paid for all the work I was putting into
sure.
it. I was working basically like two full-time jobs just on Gen 2. So we looked at doing something like Gen 2 games. That didn't work out, but I think it was a good learning experience. Then I thought that we could move to a not-for-profit model. I thought that that could be a good choice, but I didn't know how to structure it well, so I kept holding off on it. And when people would ask me, I'd say, yeah, I support the idea, but I really don't know how to structure it just yet. I don't want to just jump into it. Well, what ended up happening is that I basically got under a lot of pressure from certain Gen 2 developers who sort of turned it into a political thing. And pressured me to start the not-for-profit before I was really comfortable doing it. Because they didn't really believe that I was ever going to turn into a not-for-profit. So I went ahead and did that. And I appointed a board of trustees. And the trustees, the real goal for that structure, remember I did sort of jump into it, which was, I think, kind of unfortunate in retrospect, but the idea was that the trustees were supposed to look out for the long-term interests of Gen 2, and they're also supposed to look into issues like copyright, trademarks, and that kind of thing.
Right.
So that was my original vision for it. I think that the trustees maybe didn't understand what I meant when I said look out for the long-term interests of Gen 2. So they stayed out of develop any technical decisions and then created a developer council for that. So that wasn't something that I originally was thinking of doing. But.
Right. The Gen 2 Foundation has recently opened membership to anyone that can demonstrate that they work towards the aims of the foundation, not only Gen 2 developers. Do you think that this will help to bring the Gen 2 community closer together?
Well, I think anything, you know, I think potentially, yeah. I don't think it's going to be huge because I think that ultimately, I don't know, it's kind of strange because it's like you can become a member of our elite group, but people shouldn't need to be members of that group to do stuff. I think the key is to move to a distributed model, and then, you know, it's not necessary.
If you can, tell us something that would be considered breaking news in the Fun 2, Gen 2, or open source community. Something we can say, well, you heard it here first, folks.
Man, I don't know. I was thinking about this.
Uh-huh.
Breaking news. I think the breaking news is this is, I'm pretty sure, this is the first voice interview I've done, and you got it.
Wow, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that is breaking news. I know I hang around on the Fun 2 IRC channel, and it's really exciting over there because you can feel the excitement that everybody has there about working on Fun 2, and most of them are long-term Gen 2 users. So it can't do anything but help Gen 2, and Fun 2 is a lot of fun to be involved with. As one of the main things, I'm getting out of it is that Daniel Robbins is back in there giving all of his tips, and you're a great teacher, Daniel.
Oh, thank you. That's one of the things, probably the thing that I love about open source is that I was able to learn all of this just by, you know, applying myself. I didn't have to go to a particular school to learn it. And I like to learn on my own. I like to direct my own learning rather than sort of follow a curriculum. So, you know, I want to support people, other people who want to learn stuff too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Daniel. And I'll see you in IRC.
Okay. We'll see ya.
Okay. Bye.